Blog Talk Radio.
Hello.
You fell down. Are we ready to do that?
Hello.
Okay, we're on.
We're on. Okay, all right. I'm here, Tylon.
Okay.
All right, this is Earl Morgan. I'm coming to you from Blog Talk Radio, GoPro Blog Talk Radio. This is the Earl Morgan Hour at 7 o'clock Wednesday night, so it can't be anything else. I am flying solo tonight. My stalwart and steady co-host, Senior Plan, is not here with me tonight. I'm going to take this show by myself. And we don't have a guest tonight. Tonight, instead, we're going to talk about the U.S. Justice Report on Ferguson and other matters. But I want to talk about this because this is not only is this a shocking report that the Department of Justice did on Ferguson's police department, but it mirrors something that's happened in Hudson County and Jersey City in terms of how we've been dealt with, minorities have been dealt with in this town, very close to what's happened in Ferguson, only it's economic as opposed to police and law enforcement. But let's start out talking about the fact that the Department of Justice, as Eric Holder, who still holds the office of U.S. Attorney, until they finally do decide to approve his successor, stood up in front of the microphones today and said some of the most shocking things. Well, they're shocking in the sense that black people often know they're being discriminated against. Hispanic people know they're being discriminated against. Asian people know they're being discriminated against. But very often when any minority group, especially black and Hispanics, make the claim without having all kinds of stats and proof and videotapes and everything else to back them up, they're considered whining. Well, the Justice Department took all the whining away today. And just as a for instance, let's start with the fact that the investigation showed that there's only the population of the town of Ferguson, 67% black. However, 85% of all vehicle stops were black people, 93% of arrests were black people, 88% of the use of force cases were black people, 95% of the people jailed more than 2 days are black people. And there are 14 people bitten by police dogs in some incident or not, or other. 14 of the 14 were black people, were African Americans. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. It was actually two investigations. One into the Michael Brown shooting, wherein the Justice Department found no actual proof or cause to go forward with a civil rights suit against the officer who shot and killed Michael Brown. But the ensuing ruckus that raised, that went on for days and days all over the country, everywhere, did bring the Department of Justice into Ferguson focus and it caught the attention of the Department of Justice, and they went in and did a full scale soup to nuts investigation. And some of the things they turned up almost even, well, supposedly in this time where we have a black president and we're supposed to be working our way into some kind of post-racial situation, shows how far we really, really still have to go. Let's take what's considered the 10 most shocking findings in the Department of Justice's Ferguson report. The number one, at least one municipal employee thought electing a black president was laughable. Another 2008 email message stated that President Barack Obama would not be president for very long because, quote, what black man holds a steady job for 4 years? Question mark, close quote. Another employee seemed to think the idea of a black woman getting an abortion was funny and would stop crime. And a May 2011 email stated an African-American woman in New Orleans was admitted into the hospital for a pregnancy termination. 2 weeks later, she received a check for $5,000. And the email that was sent laughed at it and called it a crime prevention measure. These are just some of the things that the Ferguson trial turned up. They found out that people, in one case, they had a woman who was fined $500, $150 and arrested, and served 6 days in jail, but still, after getting out of jail, still owed the money. Here's another one. Black people were 100% more likely than white people to be bitten by police dogs, as I said. In each of the 14 cases involving someone being bitten by a police dog, the victim was black. For Ferguson is predominantly black, yet its police force is 97% white. African Americans make up nearly 70% of the city's population, but only 3% of Ferguson's police department. I'm reading here from the findings of a United States Department of Justice investigation into things they found and wrongs they found in Ferguson's police force. Also, black people in Ferguson were much more likely to be stopped and searched by police than white people, but were rarely found carrying anything illegal or stolen. In other words, they found less contraband on black people than white people. According to the report, blacks made the 50% of the population between 2012 and 2014, but were 85% of those subject to a vehicle stop. Despite being more than twice as likely to be searched by police, blacks were 26% less likely than others to be found with illegal contraband. 90% of police citations during the span of the report, which was from 2014 till November 2015, 90% of police citations during the span of the report went to black people. In other words, only 10% of those who received citations from the police were not black. 90% of all citations written went to black people. Police were much more likely to use force on black people. And 88% of documented incidents in which police used force against someone, that person was black. Here's another one. Number 8, black people with infractions of any kind in Ferguson, even something as minor as a parking ticket, were extremely unlikely to get their case dismissed. Blacks in Ferguson was 68% less likely than others to have their cases dismissed by the municipal judge, and were disproportionately likely to have a warrant issued against them, according to this report from the Justice Department.
Hello.
9. Yes.
Can you repeat that again?
The police made money off all of those cases that didn't get dismissed. Fines for failure to appear in court, charges, for example, accounted for nearly 25% of total court revenues in 2013, an amount of $442,901 to be exact. A mere 5% of those held in Ferguson jails for more than 2 days were not black. Yep, 95% of those jailed for more than 2 days between April and September of 2014 were black. As of December 2014, 16,000 people had outstanding arrest warrants issued by the Ferguson Municipal Court, most of them for minor violations such as parking tickets and traffic. That is more than 76% of the entire population of Ferguson, Missouri. In other words, they issued more citations than there were people in Ferguson. Now, interestingly, I heard a police union official try to give some kind of an explanation to this, claiming sort of something that I'd heard before, that all of the people who were given these citations weren't necessarily people, black people from Ferguson, but they were black people who had come in from other towns and had been arrested. That's a very weak defense. You see this sort of a thing, and you wonder, what are they trying to do? This is what happens. It's why you had the incredible response to the Michael Brown shooting. Yes, Michael Brown was a horrible crime. Not only was he shot down in the street, but he was left there 4.5 hours just laying there. And the police officer who shot Michael Brown has since been exonerated by both a grand jury impaneled in Ferguson, and now the U.S. Justice Department has also found no cause to indict the gentleman, but he has since left the police force. That's in Ferguson. But let's take a journey a little further to Cleveland, where a young man, Tamir Rice, as you may remember, was shot and killed for having a pellet gun. Now, this was one of the most remarkable and incredible and unbelievable incidents that anybody's ever heard of, because thanks to cameras being everywhere, that the incident in which young Tamir Rice was shot and killed by a police officer was filmed. It was on tape, and it showed how the police rolled up on him in a police patrol car, jumped out. One of the officers jumped out in about a second and a half, fired one shot and hit the young man in the chest. Well, now they're claiming it was a 12-year-old boy with a pellet gun. Now, they have a very hard time explaining how this could have happened. The explanation they're giving now, Tamir Rice was just 12 years old, but he was 5'9" and weighed X number of pounds, and he was responsible for what happened because he didn't do what police told him to do. Supposedly, the police told him within 1.4 seconds to drop the weapon. And then they left him lying on the ground, breathing in pain. They didn't offer any first aid assistance. His sister came out of her house running across the street. She was tackled to the ground twice, handcuffed and thrown in the back of a police car along with her brother. Her mother came along. The mother of the young man came along. They also threatened to handcuff her and throw her in the car. This was a terrible incident. And, you know, you see these things happening. You wonder, how can this be? Well, in my thinking of this whole thing, this has gone on for decades, maybe centuries. The only thing that makes a difference today and this moment is that camera. The cameras that are ubiquitous everywhere now. Everybody's got one. Everybody's willing to whip it out. Everybody's filming the police, which incidentally, don't let them tell you don't have the right to do. You have the absolute right to film them, although they don't like it. Now we're beginning to see that black people are not making these things up. There was a woman out in California who was knocked to the ground by a police officer who then literally leaned on her arms and her chest and pummeled her mercilessly, and it's all caught on camera. This is a different way now that we're going to have to do, the policing is going to have to be done because everybody's on literally on candid camera. We can all see what is really going on and where it's happening and why. There's also a difference in the way that the people in the United States have responded to this, in the sense that if you look at the ensuing demonstrations across the country, in large cities and small ones, they were thousands and thousands of people, and they were of all ethnic groups and races, and they were all screaming the same thing for justice and saying things like, I can't breathe because of the murder, or rather the death of a New York man on the streets who was arrested by police and ended up in a chokehold and eventually died while they were supposedly arresting him for what we're not even clear of yet. Nor, you know, he was supposedly selling Lucy's. But, you know, as of yet, I have not seen any proof that he was on the corner where this incident took place selling any loose cigarettes. That somehow got lost in the mix. And he was standing there when we saw him. No one saw any Lucy's. He had been allegedly arrested for doing that in the past. It is a crime to do that. But at the time he was standing there, there seemed to be no Lucy's in sight. No one was buying any from him. The police just approached him. There was some crosstalk. They looked like they wanted to take the handcuffs, put handcuffs on him. And he said, wait a minute, I don't want to go. He says that was enough for him to throw him to the ground, get on his chest, push his face to the ground, suppress his rib cage, and eventually he died right there on that spot. These things triggered a national response. People marched in the streets all over the United States. They marched in cold weather. They marched in snow. Young people, old people. It was amazing. There is something changing in America. That is for sure. It's not as fast a change as we might want it to be, but something is changing, and people of all stripes, hues, colors are about getting justice for people now. This is a very encouraging thing, because now we know we're not alone. As black people, we're not alone. Also, we now can prove that we're not whining. We have the video proof. They're saying to us things like, well, you didn't see the entire incident. Well, how much of it do you have to see? There was another incident where a man was throwing rocks at a cop. Clearly not a good idea. And they chased him. He ran. This is in L.A. He ran for several blocks across the street. And because the cops were on both sides, he put his hands up to say, I surrender. And they gunned the man down. I guess they shot him 10, 12 times. This sort of a thing is just terrible. It's not what the police are supposed to be. And on a different note, if we get back to Jersey City, where I am now broadcasting from, we have a different kind of study that is economic but does the same thing that the Justice Department study did. It was a study that was done by a consulting corporation for the city of Jersey City. It's called a Croson study. Another expression of it is a disparity study. The study was designed to show whether or not minorities have been left out or excluded, as they say in the study, from any of the from city contracts, city vending or purchasing. And the study, which was a very long is a very long document that was done between 2002 and 2009 or so, was comprehensive and complete. And it left no doubt that minorities had been completely excluded from, excluded to the point of being non-entities in terms of being able to participate in subcontracts and contracts with the city, or in selling goods and services to the city. and the numbers are shocking. For instance, there are some years. Let's take a year like 2006, for instance. The way this report is done, the way this study is done, it actually takes the various ethnic groups, African American, Latino, Asian. They even have Native American as a grouping, which is, you know, there aren't very many Native Americans left around here. The Pavone Indians were done away with many, many years ago in Jersey City. But let's take a subcontract, the numbers of subcontracts. The people that did the study, they went so far as to make sure that there were people who were capable of doing the work that the subcontracting was being done for. In other words, we had people who could do the work who were minorities, whether they be Black, Hispanic, or Asian or whatnot. There were people capable of it and available to do the work. Let's say in 06, for instance, 2006, it would start with, say, African Americans getting 0.20% and maybe Hispanic Americans getting 0.19% or 10%, and Asians getting 0.7%. Native Americans, of course, got zero. Non-minority firms, 98%. 98% of all contracts. This is true, and this happened over and over. Some years, they actually, the study shows that some years there were zero across the board for minorities. No African Americans were given contracts or a chance to buy any goods or offer any services. No Asians, no Hispanics, non-minorities, 100%. Now, why does this become very, very important? Because what is wrong in the Black community, among many things, is a lack of any wealth. During the last depression or recession, which is another way to say depression, the wealth of African Americans was substantially reduced, almost cut in half. So we're trying to claw ourselves back to where we were, which wasn't very much anyway. So you have your wealth diminished, and you start a business. You have an insurance business or whatnot. Let's take insurance just as an example. The city has many, many properties, many, 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 many properties, and it has liability insurance claims against those properties. Now, I mean, maybe we're talking 300-400 buildings or more. Each one of those buildings is a liability insurance policy. Now, I know that there are very few of any minority insurance companies getting any of those policies. However, I know of one or two non-minority claims firms who are getting hundreds of them. So why is it that we get nothing and the minority community gets none of these benefits? And these people who get that are able to use that money to move their business and progress, to buy more property, to build more things, to accomplish more things, and it's the taxpayers' dollars. The minority firms are also paying taxes. They're not getting any of the wealth. This can be said, too, of developers and contractors who build things. We're not getting any of that money. And you can't progress if you can't have any wealth in your community. Jersey City is now supposedly going through a renaissance. But is it really? The renaissance is in downtown Jersey City, and everyone is talking about it, and it seems like a wonderful, miraculous thing. But it really isn't miraculous. What happened was there was a $70 million or so investment made in Jersey City back in the 90s. When a developer came and said he was going to develop downtown where the railroad land was, right on the Jersey City Hudson River waterfront, which was mostly fallow land. The railroads had gone, dried up. There was nothing left there but railroad tracks. There wasn't very much infrastructure. There were a few jobs down there, but not many, but some. And this company claimed it could come in and do the job and did not need federal money, needed no government assistance. Well, the mayor of Jersey City at the time, Tommy Smith, stroked his chin, said, I don't know about this. I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll take your $50,000 good faith deposit, and that'll allow you to go ahead and hook your financing up, and, you know, we'll see where we go from there. Well, that was 1 year. Tommy Smith goes out, a new mayor comes in, and the developer, who was from Ohio, comes back and says, I'm going to need $50 million from the federal government to do this project, which is a complete reversal of where he was before. Well, the new mayor says, well, I know we can get $50 million. So he forms a committee, and they go and they apply for and lobby for what's called a UDAG grant, an Urban Development Action Grant, which would give you money to fix the inner cities. That's what the money was for. Well, they got the grant, $50 million, and they turned it over to the developer, who promptly flipped the project to Sam Lefrak, developer, and Melvin Simon, two billionaires. Both of these, Simon and Lefrak, are two billionaires. The mayor gave them the $50 million, gave it to them, didn't loan it to them, gave them $50 million. Now, if you go back and think about what $50 million will do in 1990, in the 1990s, that was a lot of money. And you literally could build almost the whole, make most of the repairs and whatnot that you need to make down there with that kind of money. Yes, they did need the money because there was no infrastructure. There was no water. There was no sewers. All of this stuff had to be done. But we gave two billionaires $50 million. Then the city ponied up an extra $20 million or so for other things. They put up the CDBG, Community Development Block Grant money, to a bank as a bridge loan for another couple of million. And then there was some other money they got. And they built the Newport Mall, which is, you know, it's a great success. But it's a great success because someone actually made a sizable investment in that community. It has since triggered a whole minority, a real estate renaissance down there. Land values are going through the roof. High rises are going up all over the place. The community that was there before all of this development took place is gone, long gone, because they can't afford to pay the rents for the condos and the buildings. I mean, it got crazy. The Colgate Palmolive, a company I'm sure you know, Colgate toothpaste and all the other things they make, they had a plant in Jersey City. Indeed, Colgate was the largest employer in Jersey City at the time that they were here. They had a lot of land downtown, a lot of land downtown. They got made an offer they couldn't refuse, sold the real estate off, put a lot of people out of work, and they moved the plant to Ohio. But the interesting thing, to show you how it worked, there was a building that Colgate called the Sugar House, which is a little daunting when you think that why would people making toothpaste need a place to house sugar? It kind of makes you wonder. But they had this Sugar House. And one of the developers came and wanted to develop it, and he was able to get his development going. The other thing that happened here was what they call tax abatements. Tax abatements are a fancy way of saying tax breaks. The city will allow you to build, give you a tax break for a number of years, and reduce the property taxes you pay for a certain amount of time. Almost anyone can get one for about 5 years. But some of these abatements have gone completely haywire. People have tax abatements in downtown Jersey City for 20 years. There's one in Lafayette for 40 years. And they would get these abatements, and they would then give the mayor or whoever was running in the elections, they would finance their campaigns. They would give them checks for their campaigns. And, of course, once they gave them the checks, the mayors were on board to give them. It's called pay to play. And they were able to build all of this up on the pay-to-play and that kind of hanky-panky from City Hall. Well, supposedly pay-to-play is gone. However, we found out that just like water always finds its level and finds a way to seep in, pay-to-play still goes on in other forms. But what happened downtown was it completely changed downtown. It made it a place that was on the map. People wanted to live in it. Had now, because of the high rises and the ambiance there, people want to put hotels there. They want to put cafes there. They want to put restaurants there. They want to put boutiques there. They want to do all kinds of things. And art galleries. That's wonderful. The other side of the city, just south of that part of town called downtown Jersey City, or Ward E, is Ward F and then Ward B, Greenville. They're the poor wards in the city. They're full of minorities, not completely, but mostly minorities who are low-income people who are struggling to survive. No one is putting any wealth in there. Any business starting in those neighborhoods, it's amazing because you see people who still have the entrepreneurial urge and the entrepreneurial spirit for opening up businesses and trying to make it go and not being able to do it. Why? Because one of the two or three things that the Croson study, the disparity study, also showed was that bank loans to minority people were almost non-existent. You had no way to capitalize your business. Also, all those high rises that got built, all that labor, most of it, much of it, was not labor from the area. Minority people had one heck of a time getting a job. They set up something called a project labor agreement. These developers that got the abatements were supposed to hire local people as part of the agreement to give them their abatements. The Croson study clearly shows that those promises were not kept and those people didn't get hired. It shows how if the city is purchasing goods, and Jersey City spends about $1 billion a year on purchasing various services, it shows that the same people keep getting the money, and very, very few of them are minority people. You cannot continue to do that and expect there's no wealth here in that particular area of the city, and nobody is going to give $70 or $80 million, they're going to lay down $70-$80 million on the table to rehabilitate those areas. I don't think anybody believes that's in the cards. But if the wealth that is supposed to go to those neighborhoods, those merchants, those developers, and there are developers and contractors who have the ability to build things and accomplish things, if they could get in on some of the money the city spends for the big boys, the guys that are putting up 50, 60-story high-rises, 25-story towers, if some of that money came in the opposite direction, they could begin to change that. Well, once this Croson study was finished, to show you how this works, the mayor of the city at the time, Jeremiah Healey, got it, shoved it in a drawer, and nobody even knew he had it. People knew there was a Croson study in the works. Every now and then somebody would ask a question, what happened to the disparity study? Well, you didn't really get an answer. Finally, we find out that he did have it for about 2 years. He got it about 2009. He went out of office several years later, never revealed the study, but it did come out the study had been completed and was in the drawer. And at that point, people, myself included, began to bang the drum to get this thing out in the public where we can see it and deal with it. The new mayor came in. He was in for a year. Nothing happened. Now, this is important because if you're saying that a large segment of your community is being economically deprived every day, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 12 months a year, for decades, it's time to reverse that. And every day you don't do that, you're making it worse. It was late when the study was done, and it's still late. Well, a year later, this mayor finally gets around, well, actually more than a year, to creating a committee to study the study. There's this Croson study committee that he named And it's had three meetings, and none of the people who are subjects of this study, the minorities, we have no idea of what they've been doing. Now, there doesn't need to be a long study because the Croson study itself not only documents where the disparities exist, it did something even better. It enumerated remedies and things you might be able to do or you could do to change those disparities. And they have a whole section of the study which lists all the ways that other states and municipalities figured out ways to solve the employment situations, the purchasing situations, the development situations. As a, for example, you give an abatement and a development to one of the established multi-million dollar developers here, but then you bring in a minority developer to be a part of that process and learn the ropes. If you're going to have a purchasing department where you purchase goods and services, be they toothpicks or staples or whatever else, you make it a round robin system where more than one person gets a shot at bidding and vying for this money. They have all kinds and the interesting thing was where these remedies had come from. The Croson study cited places in Omaha and Georgia and South Carolina that had found ways to fix these problems that we have in Jersey City. And we're supposed to be up north in the progressive part of the country. Well, when you take a look at this and you say, well, gee, there are the remedies. There's what you need to do. Incidentally, none of these remedies will take a lot of money. Usually these sorts of things you got to worry about where you're going to appropriate funds. Most of this stuff would just take changing some city ordinances and some city operations and regulations, and you could do it. A year and a half after this administration has been in office, they've finally established a committee 3 months ago. 3 months ago. And no one knows what that committee has done yet. Now, I understand there was a meeting last week with minorities, with at least African-American, so-called African-American leaders, and there was a promise made that there would be some kind of a session, a forum or something to tell people what was going on in these meetings and what has happened. But what gets me is there's no sense of urgency here. I mean, people, businesses are suffering. People are having problems. We have no wealth. We have no way to get anything done down here. Our insurance companies are drying up. There are, believe it or not, no black real estate firms in Jersey City. The only thing we have less of real estate firms, maybe bookstores. I think we do have one bookstore downtown. We have virtually no black real estate firms in Jersey City. Now, I'm old enough to remember when we had black real estate firms trying to sell land that was redlined in the black community because that's the only land that they could get to sell. Now that the land is worth something, where in streets where you could buy a house for $30,000, $25,000. Now the houses are going for $300,000 or $400,000. There are no black real estate firms. There are mostly chains, Coldwell Banker and the rest of them. They're all here. They do have minority real estate people, but there are no minority-owned firms. They just dried up and blew away. But none of that money is coming down into those communities where Latinos and Asians and black people can begin to recognize some of that wealth, turn some of that around, keep businesses open, and function. That doesn't happen anymore. It's never happened. Instead of that happening, we were told when we complained either that we were whining or that we weren't bidding. And the Croson study takes up this issue of whether we were bidding or not and talks about why and how it hasn't happened and how so many people are convinced that after trying to get into that process, they think it's rigged, and they don't want to do it anymore. Now, all of that is out laid out for the city to deal with. If you really care about a sizable chunk of your citizenry, a sizable that's living in misery, who's drowning under the problems of crime and poverty, you think you'd get up off your rusty dusty and do something about it right now, yesterday, 2 weeks ago, 10 years ago. Instead of that, they agreed to have another meeting of the black leadership in 6 weeks. So we'll go along for six more weeks like this, and maybe then they'll decide to do something about it in 6 months. There is no sense of urgency. There is no sense that, my God, those people down there are hurting. We have to do something, and we have to do it right away. It's like, yes, you're in misery. You've been in misery for a long time, so you should be used to it and just hold on. Maybe in a year or two we'll find some relief for your issues. That is not going to cut it, folks. We can't wait that long. We need something done right away. We need our so-called elected officials to begin to, who we elected to deal with this problem, to deal with this problem. I understand they were at the meeting and had very little to say. Now, they were elected, and you know, if you're going to be the council person in, say, Ward F, which is the ward which is mostly damaged by all of these socioeconomic winds that are buffeting it, you have to be understand that you're going to have to to work 48 hours a day, 10 days a week, because you're in a ward where misery is ripe and everybody's looking for you to help change it. If you had nothing to say and you're on a committee and you're not trying to move the ball down this, then you're not only not doing anything, you're actually damaging the people worse than they were before you got into office. You need to pick up the ball and run with it. This cannot stand. This cannot continue. So this is one set of issues that I wanted to bring to the fore tonight since we're having this show. But I also wanted to talk a little bit about the Affordable Care Act and this suit that the Republicans have brought against the Obama administration, so-called Obamacare, because they hate the Affordable Care Act. I mean, the thing about this issue with the Republicans and Obama and the Democrats, you don't want to believe, some people don't want to think that there's a racial dimension to this. That's what they don't want. But I haven't, I could be talking to a very small sample, but I have not talked to many black people, and I talk to many, many, many blacks who don't believe that this is all about race. That if Barack Obama said, you know, the sky is blue, the right wing would say, that's a damn lie, it's red. If he said the sun rises in the east and sets in the west, they'd say, no, it doesn't. It sets in the south and rises in the north. They would just say that because they don't want to give him credit for anything. He wants to try to negotiate a treaty with Iran. They have Netanyahu come here, the prime minister, to say that it's a bad deal when there is no deal. You can't call a deal that hasn't happened yet a deal. But he's getting up and saying, this is a bad deal, you should make it. He doesn't offer anything in its place. Except maybe we should just bomb them back into the Stone Age or maybe the Ice Age because he feels they're a threat and we should go as if we got enough problems in that part of the world. Of course, Israel could not be a part of any war like that because that would only make things worse. So we're solving his problem by trying to find a solution to keeping nuclear weapons out of the hands of the Iranians. But he's telling us, no, you make the deal I want you to make. And yet we don't know what that deal is. He never says. But then he gets applauded for that, and everybody thinks he's a wonderful statesman. Now, on affordable care, something like 10 million people are now in the Affordable Care Act. They're getting there, and there's testimonials all over the place as to how much better off they are than they were. Pre-existing conditions have been eliminated. Children can stay on their parents' insurance till they're 25. The state, there's a subsidy from the federal government or the state government to make sure that you can pay for it. There are glitches in the system, but there are glitches in any system when it first started. Medicare, which is now a system that no senior would want to be without. Being a senior myself, I can tell you that without Medicare, I don't know how most of us would have existed as long as we did, as we have. Now you have a problem. They don't like it. And when you ask them what it is they don't like, they never can be specific. Oh, it's terrible. What's wrong with it? It's this, it's that. Yeah, well, no, that's not, they don't really give you a reason. Worse, they have nothing to replace it with. Now, should the Supreme Court come back in June and say, yeah, we think you're right. This is the language in this bill that you passed that created Affordable Care Act is giving the states, is not really clear about whether the states, the various states should have to have their own exchanges or that the federal government can set up an exchange or whatever it's about. It's about one sentence in a 400-page bill. If the Supreme Court says, and it may very well do this, could this Supreme Court, which seems to have very little use for working people, if they say, no, we don't think this is constitutional, the answer, of course, is, well, you can fix this. The Congress can change the language and fix it. We all know that's not going to happen. So the Congress isn't going to fix it. The bill will die. And 4 million people may well find themselves without any insurance coverage. The Republicans, I've heard one say, we're going to have some kind of bridge, some kind of a temporary measure. But they don't say what it is. You know, when you have insurance, you pay the insurance company. You can't pay them on, well, maybe they're going to come up with something. That's not how that works. So I really believe that this is as much to do with the race of the man who's come up with this plan. I think that Barack Obama's problem is that he enunciated when he ran for me, he made that great speech that put him on the track to be president, that it's not a white America, a black America, brown America, it's the United States of America. You know, it's not red states or blue states, it's the United States. Well, I think his entire administration, his entire time in office has sort of belayed that fact. It would be wonderful if he was right. But it's kind of hard to believe that. There are places in this country, red states, who I wouldn't tell Barack Obama to go because I don't know what would happen to him. There are places that hate this man so much that they will not give him an inch on anything. I don't care what. If he dropped $100 out of a helicopter, it wouldn't be good enough. This is a strange, strange time we're in. And I don't know how it's all going to turn out. We'll have to see what happens when the next president, who I don't believe will be an African-American, comes in and how that all works out. Incidentally, if you wish to call into your Earl Morgan Hour, you can call us at 714-888-7444. If you have anything that you would like to add to what I say, disagree to what I say, say I'm all wet, whatever, you can call us at 714-888-7444. One more time, 714-888-7444. And we welcome all your calls. Incidentally, this show is being brought to you remote. We will be back live at a new location. We expect next week. We're looking at a place. I don't want to say anything yet, but I think you're going to like it. I'm going to keep watching my Facebook page. I will be making an announcement there. We're also going to be changing the name of our show. It's now the Earl Morgan Hour. We're going to have a new name, either the Earl Atenia Show or the Earl Morgan Hour with co-host Tina Bland. We're going to change that because Tina Bland is not a co-host. She's my partner, and she's valuable, and I think she is an incredible woman. You know, and I want to give her that recognition, and I want to give her that equality. So remember now, this is just a remote. Next week, our show will be brought to you from a new location. incidentally, which we will have a live audience, we expect. So we're going to be, when once that location is announced, we expect you all to show up, to be there with us, live on TV. You will take your questions from the audience and the phone. It should be an awful lot of fun. We have a good lineup. We have a lineup of guests. I'm hoping Cory Booker, Roz Baraka, our people of that level will be on the show to talk about the issues of the day, where we're going. We're going to have authors on, writers. We're going to try to get some of the people from the school boards on because, you know, in Jersey City, we just had this park test. Maybe you've heard of it. It's a test that essentially they want to give across the country to bring American students up to snuff with computers. It's actually a good idea because that is the world they're going to live in and the world they're going to have to function in. And they should be acquainted with the machines. However, everybody hasn't got a machine and everybody's not proficient with it. So there's a lot of derm and drang, especially on the term with the parents about how this test will work. And the state, because it's recognized that this is something that may take some doing, is not going to determine the mark of a student and leave them back or keep them from graduating on the basis of this test for 2 or 3 years. But what I think is important about maybe having the test is we will find out which students, what students are lacking in which areas, which students are not. That information itself will be very valuable to us. But there was a forum on this last week, and some very good things came out of that forum. But a couple of things that were said struck me as very odd. At one point, they were showing, they had a slide presentation showing the different questions and how this test is going to be administered. And, you know, it was kind of funny because you could see the perplexed looks on the parents' faces, and I'm thinking, they're lost here. So was I, actually, because this is the language we old folks don't quite get. And one of the things they said that I just can't get out of my mind, they said, well, you should, to help your child to learn how to do this, you should encourage them to read, but they should not read fiction. And the superintendent of schools went so far as to say that they should not read nonfiction and they should read something more challenging than the Jersey Journal. Well, okay, ma'am, but what would you expect they should read? Since you don't want them reading Treasure Island, The Odyssey, The Iliad, To Kill a Mockingbird, all fiction, maybe you want them to read The Wall Street Journal, Atlantic Monthly, The National Review. I don't know. But I just know this, as a person who read and who reads and owes, I believe, my life and my career to it, read everything you can get your hands on, everything, including a cereal box. And there's no such thing as reading the wrong thing to me. I read all the time. That's why I wear glasses, really. And I suspect that it's why I became a journalist. I can tell you right now that if you can read, you can go anywhere in the world you want to go into.
1 minute remaining.
We're about out of time now. I hope that you've learned something in tonight's show, and I hope you pay attention to what's going on in Ferguson and on this Croson study. Please keep looking in the newspapers and in the news to see what you can find out about that. That may be the only salvation the black community in Jersey City is going to get. This is Earl Morgan speaking for Tina Bland, my co-host, who could not be here tonight, and wishing you well until next Wednesday evening at 7 p.m. when the Earl Morgan Hour will return. Good night.